You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, bringing you some of the best alternative audio from the COP24 Climate Conference in Poland, December 2018. Now we go to the other end of the human age in climate change. In the UK, Dr. Jem Bendel is a professor of sustainability leadership at the University of Cumbria. His expertise has been sought around the world. Bendel is a keynote speaker at international conferences. Then, he revisited the current science of climate change. In this interview with Stuart Scott of ScientistWarning.org, Jem Bendel explains why his field is not really relevant, why his outlook on life has changed, and why you should expect the global system to collapse within the next 10 years. He is calling for deep adaptation. As a premiere on Radio EcoShock, here is Professor Bendel with Stuart Scott.
Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Jem Bendel, for having this conversation with me in the cloud and coming from a third of the way around the world. And I'd like to discuss with you today your paper, your understanding, your knowledge about the near-term collapse of civilization, which you put into a paper called Deep Adaptation.
My pleasure. Thank you for reaching out.
So first, the four areas, the evidence for imminent collapse, what we should do, what people are doing, and then eco-grief counseling, I'm calling it. Okay, let's see if we can get to all four. So first, what's your evidence for the imminent collapse of civilization?
I've been working in sustainable development and within that sustainable business. And I did that because I thought we had time to reform this system. And I stopped studying climate science after I left university. But we've been seeing all this information, really worrying information, coming across our screens over the last few years about permafrost melting, the reduction of the Arctic ice caps. And this was corresponding with the absolute, like, worst-case scenarios that were being talked about back in 1993, 94, when I was last studying climate science. And it meant that I really felt I had to go, even though I'm a sociologist and a management studies professor, I felt I had to go back and look at the science myself. So I took a year off university and spent time looking at the various scientific papers and actually no longer just accepting what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was saying. And yeah, this led me to realize that I had a completely false sense of both timeline and threat. So it shifted from the idea that we need to work to try and change capitalism, change corporations, influence governments and so on to reduce carbon emissions. And it became a question for me of how do we prepare for an inevitable near-term collapse. And I looked at what's happening and I guessed that it would be within 10 years a collapse in our way of life, by which I mean the normal way that we gain our sustenance from corporate food system, the way that we earn our money, the way we have fun and entertain ourselves, the way we have an identity in terms of the jobs we do and our sense of belonging and our sense of security. And I came to that realization because of a number of things which the IPCC were just ignoring, really, and have always been ignoring, which is these feedback loops where we now have evidence, so self-reinforcing feedback loops, where we now have very good evidence that they are already underway, which means that we are no longer in control of our destiny, that we're not in control of the climate. And those things are the key thing that's not included in IPCC is methane release, now ongoing from the permafrost. The amount of heating that's coming about because of the reduction of the albedo reflect from the ice disappearing from the Arctic and instead the sun's rays hitting the dark waters. And I was shocked to find out people like Professor Wadham's calculations that if all the ice goes, then that's going to account to 50% of all anthropogenic warming ever. which means it's completely beyond us. And so when I was doing this research, I mean, I was also seeing some of the very latest data, you know, and forest fires in Finland within the Arctic Circle, 30 degrees C within the Arctic Circle in July, as I was considering whether to publish my paper. So how did I get from there? So the rapidity of change and the sense now that it's not within our control, how did I get from there to suggesting that a collapse would occur? That's then obviously through human systems, our own economic systems. And it's quite clear that the key system that we all depend on every day is to be fed and watered. And what we began to see very much in 2018 is that the destabilization of jet stream and the Arctic vortex because of climate change brings forward the, in much more into the near term, disruption to agriculture than what had been predicted from models, where it was more to do with generic sort of changes in temperature over time. So when people were analyzing the impact of, say, a global warming of 2 degrees, that was going to definitely impact in terms of interior of continents where the grain belts are, but they weren't looking so much at the destabilization of weather patterns because of jet stream. So in 2018, we've seen across the Northern Hemisphere, not just in some countries, across the Northern Hemisphere, we've seen quite ridiculous temperatures, which then have hit grain and vegetable harvests between 25 and 35%. Now, we only have about 4 months of grain reserves globally, so we only need to see a couple more summers like 2018, and we have a major food crisis in the Western world. And we now already get indications that the El Nino effect is coming back, beginning slowly to come back. It will kick in within the next 12 months properly. Last time that happened, we saw a major impact in rice production in Vietnam and Thailand, which are major rice exporters. And they, Vietnam and India both banned rice exports at the height of the El Nino. So you can imagine if all these things come together, and that's if the weather is as bad as it has been, not worse. And the predictions are things are getting worse. So just on the issue of food, unless something massive is done now to address that, meaning how do we make sure people keep, you know, billions of us are fed and watered despite the collapse in rain-fed agriculture globally, we have got a terrible situation on our hands, which will have knock-on effects. And people who analyze the Arab Spring or the destruction of Syria point to drought and food price rises and people losing their livelihoods. So that is really a red flag for us globally. The second way that these climate changes would impact on our way of life is through our global financial system. So that there are various climate impacts which we could cope with. So sea level rise is going to be extremely disruptive to millions of people and to trade routes and to agricultural lands. But we could cope with it. The problem is that we have a global financial system which is so interconnected and so dependent on the confidence of speculators who have no interest in human well-being. And they, I should say, despite many efforts of many people I've worked with over the years to embed environmental, social, and governance concerns into that system, but basically it's still money on automatic and run by algorithms chasing near-term returns, even in milliseconds. And that means that we could see paralysis in financial markets as we see more disturbing weather events and as we see sea level rise, and basically people not in the financial markets not understanding how to cope with this. And we see insurers saying that they're not going to be able to insure many companies in future because of climate risks. So all these things could lead to a seizing up of credit markets and normal finance. And the thing is, because we now all depend so much, well, we all depend for our means of exchange on bank-issued debt and payment systems they provide. So we could end up seeing a real crisis in the basically a withdrawal of our means of payment, means of exchange. Now, that's a fragility in our own systems, which could lead to collapse and which is avoidable, because it would basically be before the actual climactic impacts were ripping things, you know, tearing us apart. It's our own system, which are too fragile in the face of these impacts. So those are the two main ways I see collapse occurring within the next 10 years. One thing I didn't say was a third way that collapse can occur, and some would argue has already occurred in some places, like Syria, is as the environmental constraints begin to feed through into a reduction in the quality of life and the hopes and aspirations of the general public, they become more sensitized to extremist perspectives, whether that's religious or particularly right-wing. And so we're seeing that happening everywhere. Global value surveys show us that people no longer believe that their children will have a better life than themselves. They don't believe that their tomorrows will be better. And they also show us that people are turning away from liberal progressive values in many countries, and there's a rise of nativism and traditional values. This, I think, is showing that people are intuiting that something's up, and therefore that social contract that's implicit that you kind of obey. You go to school, you work hard, you respect your teachers, you respect the government, you respect your boss, you save, you do the right thing, you'll have a good life. Once that's breaking down, which I think it is in many people's subconscious, if not consciously, I think we're seeing increasingly consciously, then people start questioning everything, and the people who come along and say, well, blame them over there, or just listen to me, I'm a big powerful guy who'll fix it for you, and I'll give you a little bit of an adrenaline rush by making you feel great again, then that's what's going to happen. And I think we're beginning to see it. So basically political extremism pulling people apart rather than bringing them together at this time will be a third thing. It's not inevitable. So when I say collapse is inevitable within 10 years, it's because of the impact on food. But these other two things are entirely human created and are increasing our vulnerability at a time when we need to take dramatic action to generate resilience.
You are listening to Dr. Jem Bendel, Professor of Sustainability Leadership at the University of Cumbria and author of the new paper, Deep Adaptation. Jem is interviewed by Stuart Scott of ScientistsWarning.org. This is Radio EcoShock.
But when you were just talking about the strongmen, I was holding my head because we've already got Trump, we've already got Bolsonaro. There are probably a half a dozen others that I could mention if I remembered the names of the leaders of those countries. I mean, my thing, the editorial perspective that I always insert into my videos, is that we are owned by money. Money is a meme, a thought virus. It uses us, humanity, for its reproductive purposes, and it has no concept that it's killing us. And those people who kind of know that the game's almost up are the pigs who are at the top, like Trump, who are just feeding frenzy. Let's do everything. Let's give all the money we can to my friends before it all goes down. I mean, one of his reports that Noam Chomsky highlighted for me, one of the reports he let go, this dastardly transportation report, says by 2100, we're going to be at 4 degrees C. It is going to hit the fan before then. So we may as well go for it now and pull out all limitations. Excuse me for...
I agree with you. The speech I gave at the World Investment Forum at the UN in October, when I opened a conference there, I said that we have to transform our monetary system if we're going to have any chance in curbing the worst impacts of climate change.
And that went over like a lead balloon, I'm sure.
Well, the problem is that the majority of people in the room would have been illiterate on monetary matters. And if I'd asked them who creates money, most of them would have assumed it was governments. And rather than at least 97%, if not more, being created by private banks when they issue loans. And so the problem is that just people don't have the basics. And if they're being trained as economists, what's worse is they think they know when they don't. So, yeah, it's quite funny. The number of people I talk to, and they're professional economists or even working in HSBC, for example, and they think, what do you mean banks create our money supply when they issue loans? And then I have to send them documents from 2014 from the Bank of England that confirmed that banks obviously do create our money supply. When we're paying each other electronically, we're paying in promises between banks. We're not paying in anything issued by a government. And the problem with that, of course, as you know, is that they create the money, but they don't create the interest to serve the debt that created the money.
That's and one of the problems. More. And then society ends up paying the interest through harvesting, raping nature.
Exactly. Well, if there's more debt in the world than there is money because of the way the money's created, then we have to constantly expand the money supply in terms of new loans, because if the system stops, then suddenly all the money disappears. So therefore, people aren't going to lend money unless there's actual economic activity happening. And we haven't decoupled resource consumption and pollution from economic activity. So that is therefore at the heart of the suicidal way that humanity is behaving right now, is the banking system and the monetary system.
We are in total accord on that. We can do a whole other program on that, since you seem to have complementary knowledge to mine.
But the question is, what do we do now? Because I'm predicting collapse.
Okay.
So this is an age-old issue, isn't it? I mean, Karl Marx talked about it, whereas some people said, let's try and work for change. And other people, and himself, argued that the contradictions will collapse itself. Well, we've seen that the contradictions haven't collapsed capitalism, but the environmental contradictions look like they now will. And so do we try and get monetary reform? We should definitely argue for it, but I don't think we've got time. And I don't think the incumbent powers need to listen to people like us. And therefore, I've been focusing more on replacing the system through alternatives, and whether that's local currencies or blockchain. And that's been my interest for the last 5, 6, 7 years. But now more explicitly looking at how do these systems help develop resilience amongst communities, so that when the banking system goes down, we can still buy bread off each other rather than, we can't pay each other anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still could make stuff for each other and do stuff for each other, but the banking system's gone down, so we can't do that. And that's a ridiculous... Is it a tragedy or an irony? It's ridiculous anyway. So I'm quite interested in building up those resilient payment systems as part of deep adaptation.
Okay, so now that's what we should be doing, is building up resilience.
Yes, and you can only really start taking that seriously if you're prepared to look at the latest measurements and trends on climate and the impacts from climate on our basic systems like food. I have found in the sustainability field great reticence over the years to look at the data head on. And there's been this sort of self-censoring process in the name of being positive and professional, that, let's not talk like it's doom, and let's stay positive for our donors and our members and our government officials we're going to meet tomorrow. And it was all, let's stay upbeat. In my deep adaptation paper, I go into some depth about why this has happened. And I basically point the finger at the professional environmental NGO sector and also the environmental business sector. I point the finger at them as collapsed denialists in chief. They are the ones who have their fingertips on this input with this. They're working on this and they're seeing it in front of their eyes every day, but they're telling themselves stories like, the public shouldn't hear this. And they just have to deal with it and grieve. Yes, like me, you wasted 25 years of your life. Deal with it. Start again.
Got it. The thing you said about the NGOs and how they're locked into this story they tell themselves, I got the flash of calling it not taking off their rose-colored glasses, but they have to take off their green-colored glasses. And they can't do that because their donors will not donate. There's a great example, the opening of the movie Cowspiracy, where the deputy director of the Sierra Club is delivering this beautiful monologue. I mean, it's not written. He's emoting about how serious the climate threat is. And then the interviewer who has set him up says, and there's a growing drone while he's talking. And then that stops, and the interviewer says, but how about the industrial meat industry? And the guy says, what about it? And then the music starts and the movie goes on because the Sierra Club, a major donor, is the meat industry.
I see. Yeah. Even if there weren't those conflicts of interest, there's just that deeper psychological issue. If you have decided to go into the environmental sector because of stories that you told yourself about purpose and one's own identity as a agent of change, a doer of good, a caring, respectable person, if that's core to your identity, and it's kind of difficult then, because it's really difficult to suddenly believe that, okay, collapse is coming, because you've got to completely question who you are, not just what you've done. That's what happened to me, and I've written about it more on my blog than in that paper. But it was why I found it very difficult to just not just intellectually think, oh, this looks like we've lost, collapse will occur in some way in my lifetime, but actually to really let that sink in and think, oh, okay, I'm going to have to find a new way of life. Mm. You know, I'm going to have to find a new way of having self-worth as well.
It's a radical change in your life and your concept of yourself, as you said. Your whole Naomi Klein says, if you're going to undermine or pull out someone's worldview from under them, you have to give them another worldview. You have to give them something to land on that maintains a sense of sanity and, mm-hmm. as you said, worth, mm-hmm. and self-esteem and doing. What am I doing in the world then? I mean, if I've wasted the last 5 years of my life trying to fix a system that is unalterably broken, heading for collapse, then what do I do? Where do I take my family? Where do I find safety in this collapse that's ahead? So that's another question we didn't have laid out before. Is there any safety to be found? Is the safety in our relationships with others and our building community? Myself, I don't think there's any geographical place that's safe, unless you want to move to the very, very far north where it's extremely difficult to live even now. But I do want to get to the idea of the eco-grief counseling. How do you work with people, or how would you recommend that we work with people who are coming to this awakening?
So just first, you mentioned Naomi Klein, and that if you're going to pull the rug out under them, their worldview, you need to offer them somewhere else to go to. I felt that a lot of people in my sphere were not really able to face up to the latest climate data and the impacts on human societies, and therefore questioned what they were doing because they didn't have any kind of map at all. And so that was why I decided to come up with what I call deep adaptation. And it's three key questions. And it's because also I wanted to not say there are simple answers here, because we're not in control anymore. That's the key thing. And we will act without knowing really whether we're going to be successful in this very uncertain time. So I then introduced the three R's. The first one is simply, what is it that we most value, which we want to keep? So it's a question of really going deep into not just trying to keep things as they are, but what is it that we most value that we want to keep? And then the second question is the reverse of that then. What is it that we must let go of, or we'll make matters worse? And I call that relinquishment. And then the third thing, which is, well, what have we sort of lost over the last decades in our hydrocarbon-fueled fantasy civilization, which we could bring back to help? So I call that restoration. And that could be simple things like growing food in our back gardens and spending time with our neighbours playing games rather than just sitting in our own air-conditioned, centrally heated flats watching telly. You know, that kind of, you know, really simple stuff. But I would just put it as three questions to invite people beyond a progressivist framing of what comes next. So you'll notice in that framing, it's not what do we need to invent or what do we need to do sort of like more of. It starts from a place of just breathing, letting go, and, oh, okay, whoops, we've really messed up, and let's think again with the less hubris about where we go from here. So that that, because I think any attempt to offer a bright vision of the future at the moment is an exercise in delusion. For me, I have hope that more and more people will wake up to what's important in life for themselves, and it will include things like curious, kind, and joyful connection with all life, people, and nature. And a vision would be that we find that there are many, many more people with open hearts and minds exploring together what the hell to do next, rather than being set on their worldview and proving themselves right because they are scared of the uncertainty that we face. So I don't have vision or hope where it's like a fixed way of life. It's this process that that I know we're all capable of, but we're also all capable of doing some awful things because we're frantic, because we're panicked, and we want to come up with excuses for ourselves for being selfish. You can see where I've gone with this. It's to go back to core existential questions about, you know, well, what do we value and why are we here? And what do we want to stand for, even if we're going to sink?
I don't want to call it erudition, but your thoughts are inspiring, even though they're so dire. One of the things I'm told about my own presentations is that I have this kind of amazing skill to present very dire scientific information to audiences that are not prepared for. They don't even know about the methane release going on in the Arctic. And yet they leave the room feeling energized and wanting to do something about it and not depressed. So I feel the same way about listening to you. And you're covering areas that are kind of new in my psyche. So I have to finally face up to it emotionally. You know, I mean, for years I've been in my mind facing up to it. You know, I'm planning on going home after the COP and armoring where I live, planting more food in the forest and planting more food on our terrace. But there are a million people on the island I live on, and we only grow 5% of our own food. So forget about, well.
Yes, I hear you. I completely hear you. When you hear information about a near-term collapse being inevitable, when I concluded myself this in January of 2018, it took me a long time before I went properly public. And when I say properly public, I mean using the fact I'm a professor, that I am known in my field, and I had an idea about how I could get this message across. And I didn't do that until July. And that's because I was taking time to work out for myself, what does this mean? I mean, if I was just to jump into busyness, then I wouldn't really be sitting with this. So I had to sit with it for longer. Like, okay, should I quit my job completely now and learn permaculture and join a green community somewhere in the foothills of the Pyrenees? Or should I just, I don't know, just think, oh, okay, 10 years, I'll just spend what I've got left and enjoy myself. I've always wanted to learn the guitar much better and write poetry and maybe a novel. And, you know, I had to really sink into all those questions and also really think through how are people going to respond. Like, is it right to talk about this stuff at all? I mean, are we just going to create a lot of despair, a lot of panic, some depression? So you kind of explore all of that. And I did. And what was important for me was I found people to talk to about it, and not just the data, intellectualizing, but about the feelings about it, even to the extent of I've woken up today in a state of panic. My heart is racing. It's almost like a panic attack from my anticipatory eco-trauma or fear. It's like, and I have no ideas about how to deal with these emotions. I've never been counseled on managing my emotions or spotting them. So yeah, being in dialogue with people who are going through the same processes was important. And then giving some time to go down all the different routes. So you mentioned one about how do I make my own community more resilient. It can't be done just locally. Resilience has to be at multiple levels. So absolutely people should grow their own. They should look at ways of being more off-grid, also having non-energy using water filtration systems. All manner of things can be done, but you'll just have your neighbors come and steal everything when they are hungry, or people coming from the city or being invaded from abroad. So there are multiple levels of action. It's impossible to prep alone. It's impossible to prep just with your neighbors. It's impossible to prep with your town or just your country. And so when I hear these stories of bunkers being bought by billionaires, that just shows you how nuts they are. You know, they think that they can ride this one out. Yeah, right. When they open their last tin of peaches and they come up and they're, yeah, right. Well, as if they're not killed by their bodyguards, when because money won't matter in those contexts anymore. I'm hoping that more and more of the 1%ers will realize that we're really in this all together, and you can't just prep alone. You have to have those multiple levels.
What you just said was brilliant, and that's why we're doing this. That's why I'm doing this, because we have to wake those 1%ers up to the fact that they don't fare very much better than anyone else for very long, and their thinking they will is delusional. And I don't know if they're to the point of realizing their delusion. I know Donald Trump isn't. He is psychopathic.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Well, if they're anywhere, I mean, I know your output is very well regarded, and if there are any billionaires watching, then it's clear that you need to welcome your own personal existential crisis, and you don't want to be being killed by your bunker guard in a way where you feel guilty about how you contributed to the destruction of humanity. So it's about time right now to do what you can to help humanity respond collectively to reduce the harm for all those billionaires out there, that you stop buying bunkers, start helping humanity.
Amen. I was going to say, amen, Jesus, but I'm not Christian, and I don't want to be mocking of any religious memes either. So that gets included, by the way. I don't know if it gets included at the COP or if it gets included. I may include it in the COP, even if we're live. I don't know. Right. We'll see.
Eco-grief. You wanted to talk about eco-grief counseling.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to.
I don't think there are any eco-grief counselors out there, except maybe Alison Green, who's how we know one another, sort of.
Yeah, and I haven't talked about some of the substantive things that could be done for deep adaptation either. We haven't talked about what should people be doing, and therefore, you know, should they be rebelling?
Why not? I mean, it certainly doesn't hurt to have an Extinction Rebellion. This brilliant young girl, Greta Thunberg, who I have the honor of bringing to the COP, has a huge and exponentially increasing following, where I'm told 29 cities in Australia now have their school systems being struck by their students. I don't know to what extent, but it's spread to 29. So this innocent little girl who's got Asperger's and almost died because when she realized climate was she stopped eating and stopped talking. And when the doctors told her, we're going to put you on intravenous if you don't start eating, she came back. She started eating again. And she started talking as though she had seen, as though she had seen God. There's nothing in her talk about having seen God, but as though she had seen the light. And she talks with this incredible clarity about, how can you say this? How can you see this and not immediately, you know, what are you doing? I'm told that the Secretary General of the United Nations has asked to meet with her in Poland. So there are signs that we're waking up, signs. Anyhow, eco-counseling, eco-grief counseling.
Well, I just want to have a word on that because it was good to see that she came all the way from Sweden in an electric car to join in the very first action of the British Extinction Rebellion. And I've known some of the Extinction Rebellion right from the start. And I was, I've been quite closely in communication with them. And I was one of the first signatories of the letter from academics and religious leaders that invited people to non-violently rebel because of an extinction crisis, which also now threatens human extinction. And nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, is certainly one thing that is worth trying to bring attention, to cut through the media, to reach people. But also what it does is it normalizes this sense of urgency and primacy, and that this is an existential threat. So it normalizes that idea, which means that more people can have proper conversations about then what do we do. And it's also creating lots of interesting connections between people as well around this. So I'm pleased with what it's doing at that level. Civil disobedience and a strategy of getting people arrested in order to put pressure on government is still quite limited. And therefore, it's going to be interesting to see how that's complemented by other activities, both done by Extinction Rebellion and by others. So you mentioned Greta, yeah? And I think it's brilliant that other people are doing what she's doing, for example, in Australia. I think it would be good to see a global school children's Extinction Rebellion. And I would like to see that involving teachers and parents. It's not a rebellion against teachers. But I'd also like to see it as not just calling on government to act, but rebelling against what governments have been doing to schooling and to kids. And what we need is a complete revolution in schooling in light of the impending collapse. There's a whole range of things that they do not need to be studying for anymore. And there's a lot of ways that the school kids are being damaged by our educational systems. And there are a lot of life skills, from mindfulness to basic techniques to fix and mend things. And there's horticultural skills. I mean, schools could become hubs of resilience in communities. And I think part of a global children's extinction rebellion would be to rebel against the oppressive curriculum and systems. And demand an education which wakes up to where we're at with what's coming for them. It doesn't train them up to be little cogs in a banking-driven march over the cliff. But I'm sure there'll be lots of interesting ideas being generated. But what I'm trying to do is make the connection between what the Extinction Rebellion is saying, which is mostly focused on mitigation at the moment, and these momentary moments of civil disobedience, which a few people can get involved in at the level of being arrested or put in prison, but to bridge that with the adaptation agenda and also with an everyday response where we're actually thinking, well, what are the institutions that are out there that could be repurposed to help us face collapse and beyond? So for me, I think schools will have a really key. So it's brilliant you're working with Greta. I think schools are going to could have a massive role to play if we see them as hubs of resilience. And I think it's also the most loving response at the moment, given what the future we're handing children right now.
Two things I'll comment on. One, the fact that Extinction Rebellion is perhaps working in the area of mitigation, and mitigation may or may not be relevant anymore. And I say may or may not because I think one of the problems is that, again, in our anthropocentric view of the universe, it's all about us, and our attempts to mitigate and to push mitigation on a large scale to a higher level very rapidly may save some other species besides us, may save a whole lot of, it may, okay? I'm just saying it ain't only about humans, mm-hmm. And so I think mitigation is still relevant personally. Adaptation is way more relevant, as you and I know, but humanity's got to move from the current mainstream narrative, which is we can still stick to 1.5 if we try really hard, which is total, absolute poppycock, as they say in England. So I think there's a Extinction Rebellion's great. I'm very encouraged by that. There's also one we haven't talked about, no time to talk about this conversation, which is I'm calling Sue the Bastards. And I'm going to have a program where two attorneys are going to be talking about suing. That won't be the title, I don't think. We're going to be talking about suing corporations and governments. And I'm having a group of three students from Berlin International School come week two, and they're going to talk about the failure of the education system.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
That was Dr. Jem Bendel from the University of Cumbria in the UK. His latest paper is Deep Adaptation. And you can find links to all this in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Professor Bendel was interviewed by Stuart Scott from scientistswarning.org. Check that out. Look for more interviews coming on Radio EcoShock from the NGO Forum at the COP24 Climate Talks in Katowice, Poland. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.